Meeting to, excellent. I'm going to call this meeting to order. I assume we have no public comment. And I'm looking to the board. Do you want to do the agenda review after we go into executive session and discuss with Jimmy his review? Or would you like to do that now?
I would suggest waiting till the regular meeting.
Well, that was my thought. Does anyone have a problem with that? Then we need from you, Scott, a motion to enter into executive session for discussing Jim's personnel review and meeting with him regarding same.
Let me check. Okay. I move that the board enter into executive session pursuant to 1 VSA 313 A1-3 and make a specific finding that premature public knowledge would clearly place the public body or employees at a substantial disadvantage in relation to the evaluation of a public employee.
I'll second that. All those in favor? John may have lost service. Have you, John?
Yeah, he's gone.
Okay, Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself, aye. And then do you have to make a second motion, Scott?
No, it's all...
It's all in the one?
We did the finding and the motion all in one.
Okay, so can you turn off the recording and then we'll discuss Jimmy's evaluation? John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself, aye. Okay, is there any public comment on any of, and I apologize, I should have said public comment before agenda review, but we kind of did that at the beginning of the regular the executive session, but no public was there. Is there any public comment on items not associated with the agenda? Anybody raise their hand, John?
Did Ann, were you raising your hand?
I was, but I realized that the traffic on Library Road and so on is on the agenda, so I don't need to make my comment separately.
Okay, so
I have
go ahead.
Karen's got the cutest background too.
One there.
That is like the best background ever.
Okay, so we have to approve now, barring no public comment, the minutes of 7/15/2020. And the only problem that I had with those is it referenced the meeting of 8/8, I believe, and the being the next meeting. Or maybe I misread that. I can't seem to find that at the moment, even though they're here. But if that's the case, we should change that to 8/5, excuse me. Any other corrections to the minutes? So I'll entertain a motion.
Actually, sorry, Emily, I was trying to speak up. I don't know if this is a correction, but I remember our last discussion on is John Morgan, is his last name Morgan?
Yes.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to make sure that was his, because I heard him being referred to, and I thought that might be a middle name.
No, he's John. He is John Morgan, isn't he, Steve?
Yes.
Okay.
He always right, was.
That's it. I just wasn't sure if that was his last name.
Anything else?
No.
All those in favor of approving, I need a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
I need a second.
Second.
All those in favor, any more discussion? All those in favor of approval of the 7/15/2020 minutes signify by saying aye. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself, aye. Warrants for approval. We have four warrants. 21006, which is a tax matter, which is not in the packet because that's of a personal nature. For 132.82, $132.84. 21007 for $10,186.23. That's a payroll warrant. 21008 for $19,170.79. That's an accounts payable. And 21011, $19,113.12. I move that we pay those four, and I need a second, and then we can discuss or ask questions.
So moved.
Did someone make a second?
Sorry, Scott makes a second.
Thank you. Any discussion on any of these items or any of these warrants? So are you ready to vote on that motion? Okay, all those in favor, John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. Okay, road foreman's report. Jimmy, you're on.
Okay. All right, so that storm there last night, we had, I don't know, half a dozen trees or so that came down. Got most of them cleaned up there today. We had a few washouts here and there, but nothing really out of the unordinary.
Somebody's got a lot of background noise. They need to mute.
Go ahead. Keep going.
All right. And then the other thing of it is we are doing Ron Vlogging's culvert. Monday the 10th, we're going to start it. I call it Ron Glotty's, but it's up on Caper Street up to the end. I've reached out to the Glotty family already just to let them know we're going to be there so that they knew we'd be around. I have not reached out to Peter and Margaret, but it might not hurt if we put something on this there just warning people that it'll be closed during the day on the 10th.
So you're going to do that on August 10th?
Yeah.
So you're going to close the upper end of Caper Street?
Correct. Yep.
Past Cherry Hill?
Yep.
I will get that on the list, sir.
Okay, thank you. And I know, I can't remember, I think whoever, but somebody had mentioned to me that Heidi Boley was looking to have a complete on her driveway access. And I've gone up and looked at it, and they need to put headers on the end of it. And still need to put hard tack over the top of it so they're not dragging mud out in the springtime of the year and so forth. So do you want me to reach out to them, or do we send them a letter, or how do we do that to let them know about the completion is not complete?
If you do you have her email address?
I do not have her email address, but I'm sure if I was to look, go up and pull the permit up, I'm sure it would show.
Why don't you reach, unless the board disagrees, why don't you reach out to her and tell her what needs to be done, and then she'll get the final approval.
Okay. Who was that? What was the name?
Heidi Boley.
Okay. Thank you.
And then they had been brought to Emily's and my attention a little bit about the traffic around Library Street, where people are coming off from Stage Road and turning onto Library Street coming from like Suicide 6. Because there's no stop sign, no yield sign, no nothing there. And so I touched on that a little bit with Chris Bumps, and Chris Bumps recommended that we could put a yield sign up down there, but it would have to be like a construction yield sign. So it would be more or less like the orange with a yield or however. And the select board would have to put up some kind of a formal sign, like a formal agreement, I guess, of putting that in while it was under construction, just so that it would be approved during the construction period. But if we want to put a yield sign up there, just put one in, a normal one, we would have to go back and have a traffic study and everything done. Do you want me to look further into that and see maybe if he can come up with a generic form or something like that?
I think that would be a good idea. At least we would have tried to take care of the problem that was. I got an email that one of the people that was works at the library said that she saw a couple near misses, and maybe a yield sign would help. And I forwarded that to Jimmy.
And so we're talking a yield sign because we have the basically the dual sided area down there. Is that where we're talking about, Jim?
You're right. Yeah, right at the Y. So where they're coming off from Suicide 6 and turning on the off from Stage Road, coming from Suicide 6, turning on the Library Street. There's nothing indicating they have to slow up or stop or anything of that nature.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think my thought would be the temporary one. Personally, I think the long-term fix down there is to make that a T and not have the grass section in the middle, which would free up a little bit of lawn for the library and a little bit of parking as well, and then make it less confusing. But that's a discussion for another day.
Yep.
Can I make a comment?
Yep.
So Betsy and I, of course, are both trustees at the library. And we both have concerns about this issue because it seems to us that people coming from both ends entering Library Street at the current time don't realize there can be pedestrians crossing and people backing out of the parking. And that's especially true during the summer when you have people here who are not familiar with the traffic patterns, you know, visitors, summer residents who don't really think about these things. And so it seems to me, if you're going to put up construction-type yield signs, you actually need three of them. One at the top of the road where people come, you know, down, and one at each side of the Y when people turn in, because all of those are potential accident points.
And Betsy Rhodes here, just a quick comment also about the pedestrians. I mean, we've had some near misses, not just with cars running into another, but with people being hit because they come around the corner from Pomfret Road onto Library Street through the detour, not yielding. And they, as Ann said, don't realize that they're people trying to cross. Is there any way to put up a temporary, like, people crossing sign, something in front of the library? Because we're trying to get back to our normal hours. And it's a little scary sometimes.
Is there any available parking, or would there be any available parking at Artistry for your patrons during the construction phase if Artistry was willing to consider that? Do you know whether their parking lot is full during the times that you have library hours, or is it empty?
Emily, I mean, that's a great suggestion. Unfortunately, you know what human beings are like. So,
yes, I do, but I understand you have a problem. You also have to understand that we have a problem, that if we cannot just put up all these pedestrian signs and that kind of thing without a traffic study and getting VTrans to look at it. So that is not going to give you the immediate response that you would desire and or should require. So we have a problem there. I mean, putting up a yield sign and saying construction yield sign, we can probably get away with that. But I know, for instance, when we put in the pedestrian signs and the blind entrance sign on Caper Street, we had to get VTrans up to look at that. They had to do a study to see what was necessary, and then they gave us three options. We chose one of the options, and then we were allowed to put the signs up.
Emily, this is Chuck. Wait, you cut Ann off. She was making a point, and she was making a different point, I think, than what you're addressing. So
I apologize.
What I'm saying is, yes, we would be perfectly happy if, for the time being, these were the construction yield signs that would need to be at these three different points on the road. If that's the best we can do for now, that's something. But right now there's nothing. And nothing isn't going to do it. I mean, we're going to have an accident there.
Betsy Rhodes, I just had one more. I talked with someone who has some notion about town planning and things, just because they were at the library when we were witnessing some of this happening. And they wondered about orange barrels as well, construction related. We're not talking about anything permanent. We know you'd have to do a big study and there's all kinds of, you know, steps to take, but even an orange barrel that would divide the road into lanes or something, like, I don't know, something that would slow down not only the yield signs, but at right where people cross. And yes, we could also try and approach Artistry about using some of their parking. I'm sure, you know, if it's available, they'd be amenable. The only issue we have there is that access, our walkway, where our front walkway is, and for people who have, you know, challenges and things, getting into the building already, coming from, you know, across the lawn, through the board or so forth, might be difficult for some folks. So it's just, you know, we're open to suggestions, but if there's someone else thought about orange barrels, construction barrels, maybe in the road, would slow people and warn people that there's construction. And again, it would just be construction related, so it wouldn't be a permanent thing by any means.
Do you feel these people that are having near misses, do you feel that they're following the speed limits, or are they driving too fast? Or are they driving faster than that 25 mile an hour speed limit?
What I've seen, I mean, it's hard to tell. The worst one I saw, they were probably both going the speed limit through the turns, one off of Stage onto Library Street, one off of Pomfret onto Library Street, and they happened to meet at the Y at almost exactly the same moment. And so it was just, and they weren't watching for one another at all. But they probably were going 25, but you probably shouldn't go 25 through those turns. Then the other direction, though, coming down the Pomfret Road, they do come screaming down the Pomfret Road from the north, and then, you know, slam on the brakes when they get to the stop sign. So that's, like, you can't go that fast through those turns.
I would think we could just get some of those there along the lines of the orange barrels, but slightly smaller, like they've got down by Billings Farm there that they put out oftentimes. You know, the big black base, the skinny orange reflective top. And if you put a couple of those at the intersection and maybe one up a little bit further and then one where the main crossing is right in front of the sidewalk to the library, along with some of the temporary yield signs, would certainly help alert people and go for it.
We should definitely do that. Any signage that we can put up, we should put up, any way to warn people. And this is not a new issue there. I've seen accidents there over the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've actually seen more accidents on the other side of the Tego store. People coming down from North Pomfret onto the Pomfret Road headed toward Woodstock. But I have seen accidents there at the Library Street intersection over the years. So, it's not a new thing, but we definitely, any signage that we could put up, we should put up.
Some signs and throw some things in the middle of the road to make people pay attention. Always.
Yeah.
Always
people
help,
do,
so.
Some obstacles. People do pay attention to those things in the middle of the road,
yes.
Cones or whatever it is. They it gives them kind of jogs their memory. Oh, something's going on here. Right. Maybe I should pay attention.
All right, you have a person with their hand up.
Okay, I was just going to say that the biggest issue down there that I've seen when I've been going through is that people that are going through, because they usually go on the other side, don't understand that you go both ways on both sides of the stop sign. And so you get exactly what Betsy said, where you get two people trying to go at the same time because they assume the other one is supposed to stop or the other one's supposed to stop, and then they almost smack into each other. And then they're looking at each other and then almost hit a pedestrian too, and it's just a giant... confusion. So like a sign that explains that or something. I don't know how to do that, but it would be better, like John said, if that wasn't there, but I don't think you can do that now. So
yeah.
Not at this point.
This is Jesse. I think that people, I had one other comment from someone driving through who believes people aren't accustomed to that turn on off of Library Street onto Stage Road, which is now the detour, being two ways. So they come around the detour from going north and someone comes at them going south. And it just, that's another thing. It's barely, I think, wide enough for two-way traffic, as is the other place, and we won't belabor this, but the other place that's a real problem, people are still sort of rolling stop out of Artistry's exit, which has always been a problem, but now you have traffic really coming fast at them as they don't look both ways to leave Artistry. So that's a recurring problem. I do wonder if they could have a real stop sign at their exit. Right now they have a tent with a little stop sign, which is on the left-hand side, which I'm not sure people recognize as a, you know, a stop sign, but I realize official signs mean hoops and things to go through. So, but that's just another, that maybe the yield up at that end, as Ann said, would help. But anything I think would help because it's pretty tricky right now.
Well, I'll make a motion that we get three construction yield signs along with 1, 2, 3, 4 to start with of those upright, I don't know, maybe Jimmy knows the correct term for them, but they're the pedestrian crossing cones, for lack of a better word. But if Jim orders them, or maybe we're, yeah, I don't know if we're paying for them or what, but I guess if that would make the most sense, and Jim could potentially order them. I'm sure he knows what I'm talking about.
Is there a second to that motion?
Sounds good to me. I'll second that.
Does anyone have any more discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself, aye. Okay. Continue on with your road foreman's report. I think that's where we're at.
Okay. Thank you.
Just to clear it up real quick, the four upright sticks, do you want pedestrian signs on top of them?
Yes. I would put them, yeah, why not?
Because you can get them that way if you want to, or whoever's. Sure.
I think we should, because when we were down there the other day, Jim, with meeting with those state guys, I'm sure you did. I observed that when they're coming from Woodstock and they're actually going toward North Pomfret, they roll right around the end of the bridge, not even anticipating that cars or people are going to be in that road.
Yeah.
So if we can slow them down and give them some sort of indication that that's going on, that would be very good.
Okay, so we do that, and then just make sure we're all on the same page, and we come up with one of them yield signs. And then I reach out to Chris Box and see what we come up with, a generic form or something like that, just to do this temporarily.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Anything else in your road foreman's report, Jim?
Yep, actually, what it is the Western Star truck, we sent it down for service, for an inspection. And it did have an inner wheel seal that was leaking on it and whatnot. So I had them look into that, and they repaired that. And as it was, it had a brake drum on it. So they did a brake drum drop on the back. Then they just went through and they checked the brakes. And had to put a new air dryer on it because it was all broke out. And that bill came to $2,192.64. So with that being said, they did find that the front dry shaft in it is going to have to be replaced. And to replace just the front drive shaft, just for the parts, right now is $1,500. The guy that was going to talk to me about it more and whatnot is now on vacation. He'll be back in after the end of this week, and I'll have more of a definitive price on that. I really strongly, deeply down in recommend that if we are thinking about getting rid of that truck, that yes, it probably needs a new drive shaft in the front. But if we buy the new drive shaft, it lays on the floor at the town garage and we take that drive shaft out of it, because I'm awful worried, and I had a conversation with them down there, what's going to be next? That drive shaft is weak, and we tighten that drive shaft up. And that drive shaft being in the condition that it is, I don't know how bad it's been or how long it's been. Take it out and run that truck as a two-wheel drive and come time to trade it, put it back in there. Because if not,
go ahead.
Jim, this is Scott.
We need to be looking at replacing the front end. And I got an awful funny suspicion, that gut feeling that's going to happen.
Jim, this is Scott. If I heard you right, one of the options is just to run it as a two-wheel drive.
Right. Yep.
And we did that before, if I recall, with what was it, truck 3 or truck 2?
Right now, truck 2, I was going to talk about that as well, but truck 2, I'm getting ready to send down there for an inspection. And we will find out then at that point in time whether they'll inspect it or not inspect it with that issue on the front end of that one as well. That right. One, though, we had to leave it out of four-wheel drive. We didn't take the dry shaft out of that one. But this right. One here, I'm afraid, and I talked to them a little bit about it, and they pretty much said, no, it's probably a good idea, because these front ends in these trucks have had an ongoing issue even down there at Stables with other outlets.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing the new ones we've got are two-wheel drive, right?
Yeah, I mean, we can run it. Just take the drive shaft out of it so there's no danger in blowing that front end out of it at all.
Right.
And then come time to trade it, we put the new drive shaft back in it and send it down the road.
Right. That makes sense to me.
Because if not, I'm afraid we're going to end up spending a bunch of money on that front end if you're not careful.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I will get together with them, and at least, we can get that dry shaft. I can pop the dry shaft out of it right now. It doesn't matter the one that's in it, because it's got to come out anyway, and I can do that. So we can take it out just to make sure that nothing does happen on the front end of it. So, and then that was about, pretty much the only thing. And then the Bunker Hill project, Mr. Nod has gotten back to me, and he had his hammer break down, his ledge factor break down on him. So once that's up and going, he's got another little project right in the middle of, he's trying to get finished up. And he was thinking somewhere around like the week of the 24th to come in and do it. And I said, well, if we can get it done before August is over, that would be perfect.
We've got till October to get that paperwork in, right?
Yeah, we do. October 31st. But I just want to get it put behind me. Okay.
No, I agree. I just wanted to make sure that we could get there.
And then
anything else?
Yeah, the only other thing is I had spoke to Emily a little bit about it, but I was looking to see, it's kind of a short notice here to the board, but looking to see if I would be able to go on a vacation coming up here on August 17th. No plans on going anywhere. It's just for the week, just staying home and doing things around my house.
It's okay with me. Does anybody else have a problem?
Okay with
nope.
me.
Okay with me.
Yeah, it's fine with me too.
And then you're good to go.
And some of the things for them to do when I'm on vacation would be cleaning out some culverts, quite a few of them, and finish up hydro seeding and stuff on Howe Hill. So they'll have enough to do for that week.
Sounds good.
Hey sounds Jim, great. I got one really small thing for you. But when I was driving down Pomfret Road toward the Gulf, And I know that doing a good job on the mowing, but you know how narrow it is down through there.
Yep.
And there on coming northbound, there was a sign for the mowing, but there was no sign the other direction going toward Hartford. So there were a couple of close calls with traffic going around the mower.
Okay.
So it's a small thing, but just anytime they're mowing a narrow section of road,
Maybe
it's a good idea to have signs on both directions.
He did have signs on both directions. It was just this side of my mother's house. It was the town garage side of my mother's house. So you didn't see it when you came out of Howell Hill Road and it went down.
It was pretty far down the gulf, so it was down past Vern's place. So,
well, I'm just telling you, that's where the sign was. There was a sign, and it was there today, and it was there yesterday as well. And the other day, he was headed toward Woodstock, so it was headed the other way. But there was a sign there. I saw it both yesterday and today. But it was right on the corner by Mrs. Semple's. It was not below the Howe Hill intersection. So there was a sign there.
It just wasn't. It just needs to go further down.
It could go further down, but he did have a sign out. He was not signless.
Okay, all right. It's just the place.
Better practice. We'll position the signs and better like it should have been down below Howe Hill when you put it out. And maybe going down through them S-turns might be better off too if he keeps the signs a lot closer.
Yeah, a little bit closer. Yep. Thank you.
Yep. That should be about it, me.
Okay. Now we have items for discussion or vote. Howe Hill, and that includes. Do you want to speak briefly about Howe Hill and that it's over with, Jimmy? And then we'll discuss the Pike bill that Steve talked about.
Overall, the project came out pretty good, I felt, at the end of it. We did have a meeting up there and with Horizons and Horizons and Bobby, the project manager. And there was a few things that we touched on a little bit, the mulching to get done and stuff, and he got that stuff all done. And all in all, at the end, I told him that I was happy with it. And Town of Sharon's guy was there too, and he was happy with it. Done and over with.
Just tell her. There are, like, she has
a lot of background noise again.
So basically, we are done. Is that correct?
Correct. And I don't know if you see an email today on, like, the completion form.
Yes, I did.
And I guess that's something that we need to talk about and maybe get that signed as well. I don't know.
Yes, that came in today. And John Harrington has signed off on that. And let me just pull that up here. It's a certificate of substantial completion for the subject project. It has been signed by John Harrington and the contractor, and we have to sign it. And it is asking for... received by owner, authorized signature. So I guess I have to sign that as the select board chair. And Mike, I guess if I have authorization to sign that, that's fine. But before I forget, we wanted to make sure, and this ties in with the Pike bill, that the vendors got paid before we paid the final bills. And just how are we going to go about doing that as well? But first, Does someone want to make a motion about signing this certificate of completion?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion? All those in favor, go ahead.
I got a quick one. Maybe Scott will know. But if we sign that, does that mean that we're saying that they're completed and they're getting their final payment? Or is that just saying the project's completed and then we can still make sure that the other vendors got paid?
I would think that if we sign that document, we're signifying all conditions of the contract have been met. So if there's an open question about whether vendors have been paid or not, I wouldn't sign it until you get the answer.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Well, this certificate says the work to which this certificate applies has been inspected by the authorized representatives of owner, contractor, and engineer and found to be substantially complete. The date of substantial completion of the work or portion thereof designated above is hereby established, subject to the provisions of the contract pertaining to substantial completion. The date of substantial completion is the final certificate of substantial completion, marks the commencement of the contractual correction period and applicable warranties required by the contract.
Can you, I'm sorry.
Yes, I can send it to you all.
Yeah, I'm sorry to, that very last section I would like to see in writing just to make sure it doesn't signify satisfaction.
Let me forward that to you all. This didn't come until late this afternoon.
It's one thing if we're just signifying satisfaction of completion of the work. But if we're...
That is what it appears as though we are doing.
Okay, it's just that last clause that I'm curious about, so.
Yeah, because I feel we should make sure that all the other vendors got paid.
Yeah, I mean, again...
Well, that has really, as I read this, and you all are just getting it now, hopefully, as I read this, this is saying that the work is done. It is my feeling that we will withhold payment until we are sure that the vendors have been paid. That's a different matter. We still owe them $400,000 right now. They've sent a bill. That has nothing to do with the final code of payment and or the work that they did with the shoulder. So we still are going to owe them a substantial amount of money.
I'm reading it now, Emily, and it's fine. Because that last clause is crucial. This certificate does not constitute an acceptance of work not in accordance with the contract documents, nor is it release of contractor's obligations to complete the work in accordance with the contract. So yep. That's the operative clause there. So I think it's okay to sign this as it's
okay. Kind of- so then we had the motion to sign it in a second. So all those in favor, John? You still there, John?
Yep, aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself. I will sign it and get it sent back to the appropriate individual. Now we, on Howe Hill, we had the Pike bill. And, that was a significant bill for $400,000. I don't have it before me at the moment, but I can get it. That does not include anything, excuse me, on this second amount of paving.
And does it reflect the correction on the materials that John highlighted?
I believe he took care of that.
Okay. Was it 18 tons, something like that?
Yeah, we talked about that at the meeting. And that that got discussed at the meeting, and it was taken care of, or was going to be taken care of before the day through. And I don't have that right in front of me, but I'm quite sure that it got handled. Yeah. The only thing we need to remember on that invoice as well, if you guys have all looked at that invoice, we're talking about making sure the vendors all get paid, but a lot of Mike Avery's work and what he needs to be paid for is on that invoice. So we'll know right off quick if he's been paid or not been paid for it.
Yeah, that's what made me a little bit nervous by looking at that. You could tell that that was all that work. That bill should have came along a long time ago.
A long, long time ago. And correct, because that puts Mr. Avery out for many and many days. He's well outside his 30 days, 90 days.
The only potential issue with this is we're not necessarily privy to what the payment terms were for the subs. So they could have agreed to some payment terms that, who knows? Who knows what they agreed to?
Yep.
Well, yes, but we've gotten with the Cloudland Bridge. There were two vendors that didn't get paid.
I understand.
I have no idea personally what this last bill is going to entail. I assume it's going to entail, what, Jim, another couple hundred thousand for the last pavement?
Yeah, see, I don't have any of that in front of me because, of course, John has all the, you know, the quantities and whatnot of that. So I really don't know what they were. I didn't even talk to him other than I do know that he felt that we were still going to be in pretty good shape at the end of it.
Before, I personally think, I don't seem to be able to find this bill right now, but, and I know someone sent it to me. Before we pay this $400,000 bill, I think we need to look at it carefully, and we need to, I think Jonathan has looked at it, John Harrington has looked at it, but I think we're getting to where we've spent enough money that we're going to go in, get way over our $687,000 that was bid here. If we spend $400,000, we've already spent more than $100,000. So we've got to be careful. I would like to see that final bill before we pay this one to know just where we're at. Now that's just me personally. I'm not saying we don't owe them the money. I'm just saying that I'm not comfortable saying we should pay that bill today.
I agree.
So I think we need to do some research on that. And in the meanwhile, I know that I have seen that bill somewhere. I will find it and send it to you all, and we'll move on from there. If all else fails and we need to have a special meeting via Zoom to approve a single payment on an AP warrant, we can do that. And that's my feeling. I would rather do that than not have the bill before me and not having talked to Jonathan about it.
But do we also need to go back and communicate with Pike that we want to see some evidence of commitment?
The bill lists specifically. I have read the bill. I don't know why I can't find it right now, but I have read the bill. It lists that's all of the first paving. It lists various other categories of materials and such, and I just do not have it before me, and you all don't have it at all, and so I just think that we need to look at it, and we need to talk to John about it, and we need to make sure that we aren't going to go over by a significant amount of money if we pay this thing, because we don't know what that last payment, that last bill is going to be.
If we was to pay it though, Emily, we're going to be at like 520, and then can we make that adjustment at the end on the final bill with them? I'm just fearful that not knowing what the agreement is between Pike and Mr. Avery, he's a small guy getting started out, and if they're not paying him because they're not getting paid, he could be looking at a couple hundred thousand dollars that he's waiting to get on, and we're already 90 days out.
Well, we aren't 90 days out on this $400,000 bill.
He is, because most of this on that bill was for him.
Yeah, I'm looking at the bill as we speak right now. I just pulled it up here real quick on my phone. And just about everything that's on there, pretty much, other than the reclaim and fine grade and machine pave. But other than that, just about everything that's on that bill is Mr. Avery's. It's not Pike Industries, it's Mr. Avery's.
But the bill is from Pike, correct?
Yeah.
Do we know that Avery has not been paid just because it's getting billed to us? I mean, he potentially, depending on...
I've had one conversation with Mr. Avery, and he's waiting on this money.
Be interesting to know what the terms were, because Pike is still liable to pay him. I mean, if we're, you know, it's one thing if we're not paying Pike, meaning we're overdue on a bill that Pike sent us a while ago and doesn't have money to pay him. But
well, how long ago did that $400,000 bill come in, Jim? Can you send that to us?
Yeah, you're asking me to do an awful lot.
Holler to your wife, Jimmy. She'll help you.
Here's the latest bill. I think I found it, Jim.
$750.
This is Ellen. I have that bill. It's dated July 15.
Yeah.
Net 30 days, 8/14. Let me send this to you guys. Well, you, Chuck and four others got it. You've all have gotten it.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've looked at it. And that's so what my concern is to make sure. That's why I brought it up. I didn't want this to get kicked down the road because, you know, Mr. Avery, this is to get him paid, I'm sure.
I do know that the comment got made that at the end of the project, we're going to be about 50 ton over.
Yes, but $246,000 of that bill is paved, machine paved. So and then there's $10,000 in traffic control. That all had to do with the paving. So, you know, $250,000 of that bill is directly going to Pike. The rest of the $393,000 in all, the rest of that is Avery stuff with the head walls and all of that. That mobilization is probably not going to Avery. That's probably going to Pike. So a significant portion of that bill is basically paving. You follow on that bill? Have you been able to pull that bill up, guys?
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
A lot of that is fabric. There's $10,000, $10,600 in fabric, dense graded stone, $25,000, road, which the dense graded stone would have come out of Pike, I assume. Road stub, more fabric, $19,000. Dense graded stone, $48,000, more fabric, reclaim and fine grade, that's only $47,000, machine paved, $246,000, hard pack for driveways, $924, ditch under drain, $4,600, guardrail, $5,531, stone ditch, $21,500, driveway culverts, $1,280. Mainline culverts, $26,000-something. 48-inch culvert, $13,200. Head walls, traffic control. And so there's a significant amount of this that is Avery's, but there's an awful lot of this that is Pike's. John looked at this bill, and as I recall, what John has said is there is one thing I caught in the invoice, and that was Pike neglected to deduct 18.2 tons of machine pave item that was used in Sharon when they crossed the town line while paving the 2.5 inch base course. I made Pike aware, and the town should be seeing an updated invoice with a slightly lower number. That was all I had. Ellen, have you seen a revised invoice?
No, I have not.
So if we don't have a revised invoice to take out that 18.2 tons of paving, we may lose that in the shuffle. So my suggestion would be, and I'm all for paying so that they can, please don't misunderstand me. I'm all for paying. I'm all for getting Avery his money. Don't get me wrong, but if we don't get this bill adjusted, we won't get it adjusted. And so what he's saying to Ellen, when he wrote this email on 7/27, which was only a week ago, that we are expecting to see an updated invoice. Now, we can write Pike an email, Ellen can, requesting an updated invoice. But I think it's unwise to pay until we get that updated invoice. Does anybody have any comment? Or have you all tuned me out and not listening anyway?
No, I agree with you, Emily.
Yeah.
Okay, so then is there consensus here that we're going to let this bill sit and Ellen is going to ask for the revised invoice?
Yeah, we can just call a special meeting next week if we need to before the
due date on it. We can call a special meeting if we need to. That sounds great. Is everybody in agreement with that so we don't need to vote?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Moving on then. So we're done with Howe Hill. Tego Store, is anyone here on from Tego, John?
Good evening. This is Kevin Warden from Engineering Ventures.
Is there anybody else from your outfit? Obviously not, I guess. Kevin,
Kathleen,
is that correct?
Kathleen, are you on the phone?
She is not here.
Okay. I guess it's just me.
Okay. I wrote an email to you all last week that there were plans as of Friday midday up at the town offices regarding this the intersection at Tego and what Tego was we were going to try and figure out what we could do for them and what they could do for us. Did anybody go up and look at those plans?
No.
No?
Nah, I didn't.
Anybody else? Did anyone?
I didn't. I guess I missed the email saying that they were there.
And did you go, Scott, and look at them either? I guess we've lost Scott. Anyway, so I will be the bad person.
I'm here. I couldn't hit mute fast enough.
You didn't go look at the plans either?
I did not. No, I've not had a chance.
Okay, so I have a couple questions, Kevin, and maybe you can answer them. And on C-25, you have a picket fence. How high is that fence going to be? Do you have any idea?
I think it would be on the order of 3 feet, but it could be lower. I think visibility is key. That's why we pulled it back behind the stop sign.
Okay. And is that something that you're going to leave there year-round, or is that going to be just there in the summer?
That would be there year-round, unless you have a different preference.
Okay, and on those plans at C-17, I noticed that you had the 4-foot catch basin there and the 6-inch curb, but that still says you have a 12-inch outlet. And I thought that after our discussion with Jim the other day that that culvert was going to be larger than 12 inches.
Yes, that culvert would be 18 inches. The contractor's already been made aware of that.
Okay. And let me just... then also, I had a couple concerns, and I don't know whether I spoke to them when we went down and talked with you guys or not, but one of the concerns that I have is that I don't quite understand how your handicapped people, are you just going to have those people that use your handicapped space come down Pomfret Road from North Pomfret and drive in that way, or are you going to let them cross traffic and go in from Woodstock?
They would have to come from North. They'd have to come from North Pomfret. It's basically a, you know, almost a parallel parking situation, which should be done in the flow of traffic, so southbound.
I understand that. So how are you going to educate your patrons that that's the only way they can park in there? And the reason I ask that is that unless they park with their nose going south, not north, they cannot get out of that parking space safely.
Correct.
Because your building sticks out so far and they have got to cross traffic and it's not going to be pretty. So my question is, how are you going to manage that?
That is a standard rule of the road to park in the direction of traffic. I know not everyone follows it. Beyond that, I think the patrons here are at the store and the post office, and the majority of them that will be visiting are return patrons that, you know, Christine at the store or the postmaster can certainly educate.
So you're not going to have any signs or anything along that line to indicate that they have to go, for instance, if they're coming from South Pomfret, from Woodstock to pick up their mail, they're going to have to go up Stage Road, up Library Street, and around to get to that parking space.
For that ADA parking space, that's right. Yep. Yeah, I mean, that's a space that people use now. As we've talked about in the past, it's helter-skelter there. But I've seen pickup trucks parked there right on that spot many times, and they're always parking south that I've seen in that particular location.
Okay, and then the last thing I have a concern, and that is by having your stop bar and your stop sign so far out, normally if you come to an intersection, your stop line and your vehicle is supposed to be perpendicular to the road.
Right.
And that is a blind, the way you have designed that, it is very blind into the traveled right of way. Now, mind you, I don't drive a car. I drive trucks. And when you drive trucks, you are blind on the passenger side a good share of the time. And the way that intersection sits now, when I drive my truck, I don't come down that road that way. I go Library Street because it is a perpendicular stop and I can see both ways and I have an adequate sight distance. The way that you have designed that, it is an inadequate sight distance, maybe even for passenger cars, but certainly for others. Have you considered bringing that around so that it could be perpendicular?
Well,
or more so.
Emily, this is
more likely to be perpendicular.
Agree with you that 90-degree intersections are ideal. We don't really have that opportunity at any of these three intersections. I was listening to the Library Street discussion with a keen interest. This stop bar and stop sign location came out of a VTrans study that was provided to the town in 2012. It does have adequate sight distance. I agree it's not ideal. It's a little better angle than the current intersection. I'm certainly open to rotating the stop sign further kind of around that yellow stripe zone or curb, if that would help, to bring even more into a 90-degree angle. I think that could be something we could look at.
I've looked at, although I have not been up there to see the blown-up plans, I've looked at the plans and went to the site visit down there, and there's obviously nothing ideal about the situation down there. However, given what I've seen, I think the fence is something that would be great to delineate out an area for people and keep them safer when they're in and around the store. I think it's going to kind of have to be a put it up and see if it's going to work, and then we may have to make modifications to that. But where the proposed stop line and stop sign are, to me, is an improvement over what's there. And again, given the situation that we have down there, anything that's an improvement in my mind is an improvement, about all we can ask for. But again, until there's, it's there, it's going to be difficult to know exactly what you're going to have. But moving that stop line out towards the traveled portion, I mean, there is no stop line now. There's a stop sign way on the wrong side of the road. So by putting an actual stop line, moving it closer to traffic, you're going to get a much better sight distance than what's currently there. That's my opinion.
I think the only other thing I would add is, under the current conditions, keep in mind there could be pickup trucks, cars parked right in front of the store. So by preventing that with the curb and the lawn, we're actually, I think, improving the sight distance. And as I said before, the circulation in that area, which is pretty uncontrolled right now.
Yeah, I agree. I think the biggest variable could potentially be the fence. And, yep, you know, maybe you go down to Home Depot and buy three sections of $25 picket fence, or you put some boards up out there held up by some cinder blocks in the area that you want to put it, and get in a couple of different cars and, yep, you know, do a little demo. And sometimes, you know, seeing is believing, and it makes it easier for everybody to understand. So
yeah, it'd be possible to pull the fence back as well to the north. We were just, sure, trying to create, as you say, a safe area for people that might be going to and from the store.
Yep.
Well, I think that is, I believe that the fence is important for that. There's no question about it. It would just depend how, whether or not it was a visual barrier or not. I'm sure you gave that some consideration, but I did want to ask, just because I wanted to ask. Do you, because I wanted to know, Jimmy, do you have any questions? Is Jimmy still there?
No, I'm still here. No, I mean, not really. I do not.
Okay, so where do we go from here, board?
I'd be happy to describe this. There was only a few minor changes from the original plans we circulated.
Sure.
And the changes are, at the request, based on a meeting with Jim and Emily on the site, is the curb that extended out towards the stop bar has been pulled back about 10 feet, and some striping was put in there to allow for a better turning movement. And then the curb itself, in front of the ADA parking space, would be mountable, so the fire trucks can make that turn if they, you know, needed to go that direction, as well as larger trucks. So that's the main change, as well as picking up some comments from John Kaplan at VTrans that Emily forwarded to us. So a few minor changes, although the pulling the curb back, I think, is a significant one that improves the truck turning capability there.
Any other questions or comments? Well, I think the thing for us to do then is to we will come to some conclusion as a board and get a decision together as to what we're going to do regarding. I know you talked about maintaining the maintenance of the grates, the boxes for the culvert in the back there, and that kind of stuff. And we'll get something written up as to what we will and won't allow, and hopefully that will be what you can live with and we can live with, and we will work to get that done sometime in the next week or two.
Great.
Does that sound agreeable to the board?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Any comments?
Have the lines been marked for where the new location of the curbing would be, Kevin?
Not that I'm aware of. We could have that done.
That might be helpful, so if we do stop by and see the difference.
Yeah, that would be good.
Understood. We can do that. I also want to add the other element, just to not lose track of, is we'd like to run a water line under Library Street, which will need the town's approval, from the artistry system to the store.
Yeah, I think we touched on that briefly at the last meeting. You guys were going to bore under the road. Is that correct?
That's correct. Under the road and the brook all at once. Yep.
Yep. I would think that would be easy enough to take care of.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess that's it for TIGO.
Thank you, Kevin. We'll have the lines marked and look forward to hearing from you in a week or so.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, it might take two.
Couple of weeks.
It's already Wednesday. That's why I say.
Okay.
So I don't expect to hear anything, but we will get it together as soon as we can. So all that right. You do not wait any longer. So we're done with TIGO store delinquent taxes. Is Karen there?
Emily, Betsy Rhodes is trying to.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have one question.
Go ahead, Betsy.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I was listening just in case library was involved as a trustee at the library. But just boring under the brook just caught my attention. And if you're going under the brook, depending on how far you're going, do you need a permit or anything? I mean, I didn't think you could work in or under the brook, which was part of the reason your deck and things can't leave out the building. I mean, I just don't know. I'm just curious, has anyone considered
Is Kevin still there or has he gone, John?
I'm still here.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm still here, and boring under, as long as it's not disturbing the brook, is an acceptable approach. But certainly trenching or anything like that would not be without a permit.
So you're going low enough that it's not going to impact the...
Correct.
Brook. Okay, cool. Thank you.
You've talked to Natural Resources about that anyway, haven't you, Kevin?
Yes,
at least I got a notice to that effect.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Anything else, Betsy?
No, thank you. That just caught my attention. I was like, wait a minute, I thought we weren't touching the brook, but it's all good. Thank you.
Is Karen Hewitt there, John?
I am here, yes.
Okay, Karen is up with delinquent taxes.
Okay, what would you like to know?
Well, you talked about you were considering some tax sales, so.
I am. There's two.
So you better give us your presentation as to what you want to do.
So there are two properties. So out of the properties, one of them, I'm talking like the ones with the significant amounts. One of them, I am actually in talks with their mortgage company. And they are putting pressure on the property owner as well to pay money. And we actually just got a $5,000 check from him the other day. There is another property that I am talking with the trust and lawyers, and they are either going to, it has to go before a judge. A judge is actually in charge of this property. They're going to sell it, or they're going to pay the delinquent taxes out of the interest from this trust. But there are two properties that they're just not gonna pay. I've already talked to one and he's like, I'm not paying. And then the other property. So there's two. One is the Carpenter property, which is down across from Keith Sawyer's house, down towards the Gulf. They owe only about $5,600, but they're not paying. It's in an estate. One person's paying, the two other siblings are not. So this is more of like to basically to kind of trump the hand and say, you know what, you need to pay the delinquent taxes. The other property is the Levinson property, which is on 25 Orchard Hill. Jessica Levinson owes $92,000. I have talked to her numerous times. I've tried to get her to go on a payment plan. I've sent her, you know, notices saying you need to contact me. We need to talk about this. We need to pay. And she's just not. So I would like to start the proceedings to put those two properties up for tax sale.
And Karen, this is Scott.
Yep.
The Levinson property, as I recall, what didn't she contest?
She did. She was the one that came for grievance.
Right.
On the board.
Right.
She came twice for abatement.
Yes.
Two different years.
For grievance or abatement?
Abatement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you need a motion to give you authorization to put these two properties up for tax sale?
Yes, that. And then we need to decide when we want to hold the sale. Ideally, probably it would be in a select board meeting. I've calculated out the timeline because these two properties, because these two properties are owned by out of state residents, you have to, it's an additional time. So I would need to send a certified letter within 20 days and then start a 30-day notice. And then after that, put it in a paper for three weeks consecutively, wait for 20 more days to even have the hearing. So right now the hearing for the sale would be either November 18th or after.
Well, that's fine. As far as I'm concerned, does the board have any feeling as to when you want to do this?
It sounds like we just need to let the process play out.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
when I put the
notice in and when I send the letter, I need to detail when we're having the sale. I need to detail exact dates.
Okay.
I also need to be like, are we going to do it via Zoom? And if we are we going to get bids in like an RFP? Like the bidders would send in what they want a bid amount. I would have the starting amount of what the sale would be to cover the taxes, the late taxes, and the upcoming ones, as well as the cost for the paper and anything else like that would be in there. And they also, the other thing that the board needs to do is, are they going to appoint somebody from the board to, if nobody, if we don't get any bidders, like the other sale, like the Dunn and the Salmon place, the board actually appointed somebody to act as an agent for the property. And then the town actually ended up owning those two properties.
Right.
Is the town gonna wanna do that with these two? So that's something that the select board needs to decide what they wanna do before I start the timeline.
My personal belief would be that if we they're non-performing at this point, so even if we have to hold them for a year and then sell them off at a bid price, we're still better off than having them be non-performing, especially since that Levinson property hasn't been paying since 2012 or something.
Yes.
So it's time to do that. So I would think that the board would authorize an agent to put in a bid for the amount of taxes if we get no other bids on the property. I think that we might want to be a little more aggressive and notice it, the tax sales on the town website, and perhaps on the listserv, or send notices to abutters or something, so that we generate a little more.
Notices are sent to abutters per statute.
But my feeling is that we start, my personal feeling is, let's start the process. You pick the date that you can do all your paperwork and have the sale, and we will just schedule it at that particular meeting. And it's going to take us a long while, but especially these two non-performing accounts that have no desire to pay, obviously, it's time to get them, time for something to happen. That's just my feeling.
Does the board want the bidders to send in the bids and then have them be opened? Normally, we would go at a public hearing. People would come in, they would bid, then they would the final price would and bidder would be identified. They would sign a piece of paper, or give 10% down, and then within 10 days out. But if we're going to do it via Zoom, we don't have a contract that's being signed or a piece of paper or an IOU being signed. If somebody came onto Zoom and said, yes, I'm going to bid $100,000 for this property, and then they back out, we're going to have to start all over again.
We should probably, before we make any decisions, check to see if there's been any changes in Act 92 in relation to this process with COVID-19.
Yeah.
There have been a number of things that have been change process-wise, so I would suggest we do a little homework before we figure out what process we want to follow.
I agree that we need to figure out how we're going to do it. Are we going to do the RFPs? We're going to get bidders to bid in, and how do you do it via Zoom? I mean meetings are one thing, a tax sale is another.
Right. Yeah. So why don't we?
Go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, why don't we take some action items out of this and figure out a game plan and go from there.
The other thing, you could, depending on how many people were to show up at an auction such as that, which is basically what you're doing,
right,
is we could have a socially distant person-to-person auction at the town hall, because you have enough room there that you would not get a significant number of bidders there, and they would have to come and bid in person. You might generate more interest if they didn't have to come in person. I don't know. But that is also...
There must be a way. I mean, they hold online auctions for all kinds of things where people call in, that if you're an interested party, that you could then sign something ahead of time that would legally obligate you to pay if you were the high bidder. I don't know. It's certainly something that would need to be vetted out first, but there's got to be, a way to do that.
Usually, for instance, if they sell properties at auction, they ask for the bidders to bring a bank letter of credit.
Right.
And so you would ask for them a bank. Not only would you ask for, let's say, a $10,000 deposit, but you would also ask for a bank letter of credit so that you would know that $10,000 check, which you would return to all of your non-successful bidders, but that check would indeed be acceptable and a good check. But how these things exactly work, I am not familiar. I think we need to do a little research. But if you want a motion to go ahead and research and start the process for a tax sale in order to do the research and not waste your time, we can give you that kind of motion if that's what you would like, Karen. Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely need, we, these two properties are just going to sit there and they're just going to snowball and they're just going to accumulate more delinquency because neither one of them are going to pay.
So I would move that Karen investigate the legalities of holding tax sales on both the Levinson and Carpenter property. And when we determine how we can legally do that over Zoom and whatever, that we authorize her to go ahead and schedule those.
I'll second that.
Any more discussion? All those in favor? John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And I'm an aye. So research it. If you need any help, there's always VLCT, and they would probably give you some guidance if need be. And Scott, are you going to try and research that a little bit to see what is the law at this particular moment regarding such things?
Yeah, I'll see if there's anything that speaks to it. I'm not sure I'll find anything, but I'll look.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Karen, for coming. We appreciate it. Anything else you need?
No.
Thank you. Galaxy Hill cutout issue. Are you still there, Jim?
Yeah.
Is Jimmy still there, John?
He is still here. He answered here. Here.
So you have the floor again.
Okay. Well, so all I can tell you is I get mixed up with his last name, but there's a resident up there named Sam. Maybe somebody can help me with his last name.
Neustadt.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, he has gone and put a stone wall out. Cam Creedy's dead. They built a stone wall out in the field area out in front of his house, which looks very nice and whatnot. And after he got it done and he wanted to backfill it in and put like a lawn area, and he got to looking around and he says, oh no, I got a cut out there, you know, that takes the water. So he called me up, wanted me to come up and look at it because he was looking to move it. Well, as it was, that was kind of the agreement when he built the place. He brought around where he wants to put his lawn to come in to the end of the culvert and clean it up. We're going to lose that. So he said, well, I would let you cut these trees so you could access, or he would cut the trees and give us an access to get out there. And I said, okay. And then in the meantime, the town culvert comes across over onto his lawn. There's a town culvert there, and it has a manhole on it, a drop inlet that goes down into the culvert. Well, the water in the past hasn't been making it there, and so I talked to him about validating that. Well, if we validate that, which he's fine letting us do, if we validate that, that's going to split the water in about half the distance from where it's going now down to that cutout and making a mess. So what he is asked now to do is to discontinue that cutout that dumps out onto his lawn and move it down the road about 30 feet. Well, at first I was kind of being stern with him about it and whatnot, and then the more I thought about it and looked at it and thought about it, if he is fine with it and still and wants us to move that cutout down 30 feet down the road, I would think that we probably would be okay to do that. But my thing of it is, do we need stuff in writing, number one, when we do stuff like that?
My feeling is, Jim, you can move the cutout down the road, but we've got to I looked at that cutout or whatever, not the cutout, the manhole, and that's not a very big manhole. And the water right now can't get to it. So we've got to either build up the road or cut a ditch in his lawn to get the water to that manhole. And if we can't get the water coming down by his driveway where he didn't want a culvert to go to that manhole, then we can't lose that cutout down below.
Nope, he's fine with us Because I had talked to him anyways about, you know, if we validate that, you know, we're going to have to dig it out, maybe berm it up, build it, I mean, right there in that area, not build the road up so much, but either put a berm out there, or do whatever we had to do to make sure that that water got to that point. And I also told him at that point in time, I said, if something else fails, it's going, it could, you know, go over the top of the manhole and go out there. I said, so you would have to see to it that you kept that manhole cleaned up and open. And he said, he, by all means, he said he would do that. So he's willing to let us do all that. So I think if we can get it done and it all works successful, I don't see what, in my mind now, at first I was kind of sketchy on it, but I would be fine on him moving it down the 30 feet as long as we know, like you say, that that manhole is done.
So then the other thing you asked is, do you need something in writing to facilitate this so that this doesn't get lost in the shuffle when we're all gone and somebody else has to deal with it?
Well, yeah, because, and the reason why I say that is because, I mean, yeah, at first he kind of was like, well, I don't really remember us talking about that. But he wanted to build the house and us giving up the culvert, and well, giving up the water bar that where his driveway is now and giving us the right of way or the access to be able to come in and clean that culvert. But then at the end, I think it started coming to him a little bit. So with that being said, that was a deal where it was done verbally, you know what I mean? And I think by doing this again, we need to make sure if there's anything we can do in writing or whatever, so that it's documented that everybody, all parties were agreeing on it being put there, and this is the way we've got to access.
Are we going to be outside of the town right of way with this work?
Yep, the end of the culvert, to for us to go out and clean the end of that culvert, it would be just about, I think it would be pushing it, John.
It wouldn't, you know, whether we want to do it on this or not, but we, anytime we're getting permission from somebody to put something such as that, that's going to be town infrastructure outside of the town right of way, we should either be gaining legal right of way to that or an easement. Which, to that, I know working with the fire department, all these dry hydrants that we put in ponds years ago, not so, but now in order to gain state funding grants for these hydrants, we have to have landowner easements that guarantee the fire department a right-of-way access to these basically for the life of said project so that a future homeowner, or they can't get mad at you 10 years from now and legally prevent you from maintaining something that they once allowed. So
I think John is correct. I think we need an easement from him to maintain the culvert and maintain the culvert, that catch basin in the culvert, and because otherwise down the road when he sells to someone else, they'll say, no, you can't maintain it anymore, and then we'll lose it, and you won't have the cutout down below. But we can get an easement together for that, and maybe we should ask him to have, so that we don't get into legal fees, we should ask him to have his lawyer draw up an easement, and then we can look it over for that culvert and to maintain it and replace it if necessary, and maintain the waterway there. So I think John is right. A legal easement is in order. Anybody else have any thoughts?
Not other than to agree.
Yeah, I agree as well.
So, Jim, why don't you talk to him and tell him if you want to, tell him you'll move the cutout, but we need a legal easement to maintain that, and the water has to go to that upper manhole, and we need a legal easement from him to maintain that in perpetuity.
Okay.
See how that goes, and if we need to address it later, we will.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on that? No. Truck bids. Steve, John, and Jimmy, I guess you're on for that.
So we reviewed the bids. There was a wide variety, I guess you'd call it a wide variety, in pricing. But after reviewing the bids, especially the two lower priced trucks that one of them was from ATG and the other one was from J&B. They're basically a bare bones truck. The truck from J&B, there was stuff that was in the RFP that they didn't include in their bid. So I don't know how technical we want to be on that, whether we want to disregard their bid because of that. But what I did was, especially on those two trucks, with that being the situation, I made a phone call, asked some questions, and compared them to the two trucks that we already committed to purchasing from Clark's. Went through it line by line. Last year, myself and Jimmy and John and the guys that down at the garage spent a lot of time on it and determined that this is what they needed for a plow truck. So after comparing it line for line, the Freightliner truck from ATG, we need to add $6,478 to that price to have the same equipment as the trucks that we got currently have coming. And the J&B International price, we need to add $8,538.
So if you add those amounts, you didn't send a spreadsheet to us, or did you? You didn't, did you?
We haven't, no.
So how do things, if you add those things to make us compare apples and apples on each of these vehicles, how do the bids then stack up?
You would then, it would go with the number two bid of Clark's, would be the exact same truck as we currently have coming. And that would be the best price as well.
And how much is that going to be?
It would be $153,956. And I think John can speak to this a little bit too, and maybe Jim. Clark's offers an on-road service, which is huge. They got that warranty. The ATG doesn't offer the towing. And also J&B didn't offer the on-road service.
What I think you should do is put it all out in a spreadsheet. And I'm just one person, so if nobody else agrees, that's fine. And we'll go to plan B. Put it all in a spreadsheet as to the make of the truck, who's offering it, and then what it's going to cost us to get the exact same truck from each of these individuals when you have to add all of these extra items on that they didn't include. And then if you can get that to us before the next meeting, then we can make a decision.
Okay. And
does anybody feel that they need to see that?
Yeah, I'd like to see it, yeah.
If I'm just alone, tell me so, and I will.
You're not alone, Emily. I feel the same way.
Yeah. Yep, makes sense.
So
and give us, how technical do we want to be? Do we want to accept the J&B bid when it didn't include some of the things that we asked for in the RFP, or do we
there's
not?
There's two ways. Go ahead, Scott. I'm sorry.
I was going to say it depends on whether the things they left off. So typically how you would handle something like this is you go back and say, hey, there are some required things we needed you to respond to and give them a chance to respond. And if they don't respond, then typically you would consider the bid to be non-compliant with the requirements. But if they are more along the lines of optional things that we asked for that were not necessarily requirements, but things that we would have liked, then it's not as much of a compliance issue.
No, these weren't optional.
They were not.
No, they were specifically stated in like the upfit of the trucks, you know, that kind of thing that we were asking for.
And you went back to them and gave them a chance to get compliant?
I didn't, because I didn't know that we should do that after we already, you know, after everybody bid on the exact same thing and they didn't include it. I didn't know what the next step.
You don't have to be, I mean, we can certainly take a more strict approach and say, look, you know, there's no second chance here. You didn't submit it the first time. You're not compliant. So therefore you're excluded. Or you can go back, because sometimes vendors do miss things, and say, hey, these were required. We're going to give, and you have to, the issue is that you have to give everybody the same opportunity. You can't just give one vendor. So the way to handle it is you go back to all vendors and say, look, we, without naming names, you can say we had compliance issues, and then you can say one last chance to amend your bid to get compliant with the RFP. But we don't have to do that. We can say it wasn't compliant the first time, and we're not going to consider the bid.
I would think that the latter approach would be better, in that if you give each of them an opportunity to upgrade their bid with the things that we felt were necessary, then you have a valid, well, one, you have a valid bid process, but also if you exclude, you've only got three people to deal with here, and if you start excluding two out of the three, then the third person that gets the bid is going to feel quite comfortable, so that the bids will not be competitive somewhere down the road. And so if you want to encourage multiple bids on these RFPs, it's probably to our advantage to go the route, as you suggested, these are the things that were missing from your bid, and we feel that they are necessary items. Do you wish to amend your bid to include these items? And then if they choose not to, then you go with the one bidder that did put them in. But that way they know that you are willing to, that way they will be more willing to bid in years going forward. And the idea is we want some valid bids, so that, and it keeps all of these vendors honest and hopefully gives us the lowest possible price for the best possible outcome. So I would go the route of giving them a chance to comply with the bid, and then if they choose not to, then they've been given that opportunity. Okay. Now that's just my feeling. Anybody else have any thoughts other than Scott?
So, but that means that we can't just go to that one and say, would you like to resubmit your bid, including these things? We have to ask all of them somehow to relook at their bid?
Two of them.
No, I know, but I'm talking about what Scott said. You can't just single one out. I'm not clear about that.
So, Chuck, what I mean is that the theme in procurement in general, hey, get your chin off of there. The theme in procurement is, just as you're saying, Chuck, you have to offer the same opportunity to every vendor. But that doesn't mean, while basically the message to vendors is, listen, we had some compliance issues with the bids. we are going to create a 1 or 2 week period, however long is appropriate, for vendors to amend their bid to get compliant. And then you can go and talk individually with each vendor and articulate to them where they were not compliant.
I'm still not clear about that. But so we can't just go to the one that we're talking about.
What you would do from a formality standpoint is you communicate with all vendors and say, we had compliance issues with the bids. We're going to create a 1 or 2 week period where we're going to provide an opportunity for all vendors to get compliant. And then you can have individual conversation with each vendor and say to them where they were not compliant. And if there was one vendor who was 100% compliant, the message to that vendor is, hey, you didn't have any problems, you're good to go.
That sounds all right to me.
I guess so, yeah.
The only question I have is, why do we do RFPs if we're going to go through that ringo? If they're not capable enough to follow that RFP, why is that the town of Pomfret's explanation to them?
It's not. Like I said, we can be tough about it. Actually, Emily's point is a good one, is that there's the compliance aspect of bids, but then there's, Emily made, I think, a really good point about you want to create an environment that is fair and a level playing field, but you also want to create an environment where in the future, you're going to increase your chances of getting bids in the future as well.
But how more self-explanatory can you be with an RFP on being fair to everybody?
Yeah. I mean, you're right, Jim. I mean, sometimes, not to be blunt, but sometimes it's like, geez, how hard is it to follow the instructions?
What I mean, it's whatever. I mean, I just see it that way.
Yeah, I get your point, and it's a good one. But in all the years in my experience in government procurement, sometimes you can have the most straightforward RFP, and people will still screw it up.
Yeah.
Well, So the question is sort of, do we want to do business with somebody who we already know their work is questionable? Of course, on the other hand, we know that the people who are making the bids are not the ones who are actually building the truck. So
that's right.
May not be valid either. So
right, that's actually a good point, Chuck. Is that the you have salespeople and the people? Oftentimes, the people who are responding to the bids are not the people involved with building the truck. And sometimes there are honest mistakes where people just honestly missed it. So
yeah.
Well, you can take Jimmy's tack, and you can say, and to be quite honest, after Steve's research, Clark's is still the lowest bidder, and they gave a bid with all the things that we asked for. And Steve went to the effort of asking the other two bidders of what those extra things were going to cost, and they still were higher than Clark's. And so we have every reason validly to say Clark's had the lowest bid if we choose to do that.
Yep.
And that's perfectly fine with me as well. By Steve calling them, he did give them an opportunity to price out those extra things that they did not include. And I personally agree with Jimmy. How difficult is it to put, you know, they do all this on the computer. All I got to do is push a button, and it adds the air seat or detracts whatever it is. So it's not like it's rocket science in pulling out these amenities that come in these trucks. So we can take the other tack, and we can look with these amenities, and we can have them do their spreadsheet as to what exactly it's going to cost, figure out whether we have enough or will have enough money to buy the truck. And I don't really think we have a choice anyway, but that's another discussion that we'll deal with in 2 weeks. And we can just leave it as it is and say, and just take what we have plus the information that Steve got from the other two bidders, and we can just do that. Because in the end, Clark's is still going to come up the lowest bid.
Yeah, we can do that, and that's perfectly valid.
That as well, as far as I'm concerned. My point is that you want these people to take you seriously so that they put in a low bid so it keeps them all honest. They all are out to make a living. They all are out to make a profit. I understand that, but we don't want them to make any more than they absolutely have to on us by keeping other bidders interested in dealing with us as well. And so I understand Jimmy's point. How challenging is it? This is what we want. Price it out. And so we can do that. And I have no feeling either way.
So both approaches are perfectly valid. Yeah. And so there's nothing wrong with going either course.
Steve obviously has done his job, but he's also gone several steps along the way to doing their job for them by making the call and asking them for the information that they should have included in the first place. So I think that we could look at it that way for sure.
Yep.
So we need a motion here to either go back and have them amend their bids or a motion for Steve and whoever to get out a spreadsheet so we can make a decision at the next meeting. And at that time, we can figure out also what is in the reserve accounts and do we have money enough to buy this thing when we get there, when it comes here in a year from now, which probably is a no-brainer and no choice anyway, because the truck is the problem. So I need a motion as to which way you want to proceed, and anybody that wishes can make that motion.
I'll make the motion we'll go ahead and put the pricing and information on a spreadsheet and make a decision at the next meeting.
Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second that.
Yeah. Thank you all. Are you ready to vote on the question? Hearing no answers, I assume you are. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. We'll see the spreadsheet at the next meeting. Moving on to the agenda. 8:51 now. We still have a driveway permit, cost of living increase, Mary Pace Bay. Do we want to leave conflict of interest policy until the next meeting?
It should be
because
a quick
I can see that some of these other things are going to take a while.
Well, unless there's a lot of discussion, it should be pretty pro forma. I saw Chuck's comments. It sounds like we're at a point where we can adopt it.
What does anybody feel? Are they ready to adopt that conflict of interest policy? I would have preferred to see it in the agenda packet. I expected to find it there so the public could make some kind of comment. But I'm willing to go either way. It's whatever. I just think that we've got a lot of things to get done here, and it's getting late.
Yeah, maybe we should. It should go in the agenda so that everybody can read it. Yeah.
So let's get that in the agenda packet for the next meeting, and we will adopt it at that point, and then the public can have a chance to comment if they wish to. Is that okay with you, Scott?
That's fine. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
Okay. Next meeting. And Cindy, can you put that in the package next time? She must be there somewhere. Okay, driveway permit for Lucott on Starbuck Road. I don't know whether Jimmy is still here or not. Are you, Jimmy?
He's still here.
John, is Jimmy still here?
Nope.
Why don't you speak to this issue? And the drawing did not get put in the packet, just the front side of the permit. So you'll have to explain what they want to do and whether or not you feel a site visit for at least some of the board is necessary.
Okay. So what it is up on Starbucks Road, Chuck Luca bought, and maybe Emily could help me out on whose property, but like Kennison property.
It was actually Stetson, but Kennison rented up there, but that's okay.
Okay. So, and he's proposed to, number one, he thought maybe he could have two driveway accesses and use the one that was there, and then proposed to put in another one that's a farm access road just a little ways above there. And I said, no, use as a rule of thumb, only one access. So I met with him, and he's got a stake up there, and he's looking to discontinue the access that they were using for the residents when they were renting it. To discontinue that one, come up the hill from that, which is site distance, it's fine, and he'll be able to get the grade off the road and everything. He's going to come up the road from that, I think, I can't remember what it was, but maybe 25, 30 feet up from the existing driveway that he will discontinue, and go up in, and then he's going to incorporate dropping down over into that existing access that's there, but it'll be closed off at the road to pick that one up. So he'll still have one access off from the town road. He's going to get back in there probably 60 yards, maybe, or maybe more than that, or a little bit less. And then he's going to incorporate that other access into that. So I told him whatever he did back there didn't matter to us anyways, just as long as there's one access. And I personally don't see it being an issue or a problem at all with where he wants to work. But if you guys would like to come up and take a look at it and postpone it, but as it stands right now, the site distance on it is plenty of site distance both ways. And he assured me that it is 20 feet and that I could come up and when they were doing it, the whole deal. So I don't see it being an issue.
I did go look at this with Jimmy. He asked me to come down there and try and figure out what was going on. And it looked to me like he had adequate site distance, and both Jimmy and I discussed it. He was not there, but we discussed it that he could not have two access, and as long as he could get it level to go into the road and put in a culvert, that we didn't think that there was any problem there, but that he could only have one access, he couldn't have two. If you all want to do a site visit before we give him a permit, that's fine. He's kind of champing at the bit, but if you all feel that you want to go look at it, that's fine too. Jimmy didn't know whose land it was or anything, and that's why he asked me to go down there. I think it's okay, but if you all want to go see it, we'll schedule a site visit, and then we can approve it at the next meeting. It's whatever you prefer.
I think if Jimmy approves it and you looked at it and feel that it's fine, I trust Jimmy's judgment.
As long as there's only one access on the road, I don't care what he does out in his piece, but we don't want to get in the habit of giving more than one access to a piece of property like that.
Especially until we change the ordinance, right?
Well, I would hope that we wouldn't change it, but that's another matter. We were not going to go there tonight. So if indeed you want to approve that with the condition of a culvert and level for 20 feet, and that's all we thought it was going to take, right, Jimmy?
Yep.
Then I need a motion to that.
What size culvert?
18.
Okay.
So I need a motion to that effect.
So moved.
I need a second.
Second.
All those in favor, John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself, aye. Jimmy, motion carried. Jimmy, will you indicate to Mr. Lucott that the conditions, and I will go up and write those conditions on the permit and sign off on that.
Yep.
Okay. cost of living increase, road crew, and all employees. I put the road crew on there. We a year ago, and Scott added all employees, and I don't know how you feel about that, but the reason I put the road crew on there was a year ago we gave a cost of living increase based on that COLA rate that is published to our road crew starting the beginning of the fiscal year, and at that point, with the board that was there, we indicated and intended to give our road crew a cost of living increase according to those COLA rates on a yearly basis at the beginning of the fiscal year. Well, we haven't authorized that and done that, so that's why I put this on there, and it's up for discussion if you want to include all employees with that, whether they're salaried or hourly, and or whether they're whether they are appointed or elected. There is only one sticky wicket, and that is that the delinquent tax collector is paid a stipend, which was voted on by the town. And I am unclear as to whether, without a vote of the town, we can increase that.
Yeah, so Emily, let me qualify the agenda item. I think it got mischaracterized. I actually thought I had stated it should only apply to people who are paid an hourly wage. So anyone who is paid a stipend, and especially in the case that you described where the pay is set by the voters, that obviously is out of scope. We couldn't do that, but we could certainly put an article in front of voters for a cost adjustment, cost of living adjustment for anybody who is paid a stipend, but or paid by virtue of town vote. But I think any, as a matter of fairness, anyone who is paid an hourly wage really should be eligible for the same cost of living adjustment. You know, everybody has the same, pressures from a wage standpoint. And just to be consistent and fair, and this just, you know, as I mentioned over email, this is something that I raised with the board a couple of years ago. And at least at that time, the board was in agreement that this is something that we should take up. So I do believe pretty strongly that the cost of living adjustment should apply to everyone who's paid an hourly wage.
So would you like to make a motion to that effect, Scott?
Sure. I'll move that the 2%, and right now it's a static 2% cost of living adjustment, that the board authorize a 2% cost of living adjustment for all appointed, elected, and employees who are paid an hourly wage to receive the 2% cost of living adjustment starting on the beginning of each fiscal year.
I thought that COLA rate was 1.6.
I look back in the minutes and I thought it was 2%, but if it's 1.6, that's fine too.
Well, no, that changes on a yearly basis.
It does. I couldn't recall whether it was pegged to a static 2% or whether it was pegged to the current rate of inflation.
It is, Emily, it is 2.0.
It's 2.0?
Yep.
Usually those COLA rates, you pull that statistic out of, there's a Boston area COLA rate. And it varies from regions in the United States, and I think it would be if we want this to go on year after year and be pro forma, it would seem to me that we would not give it a percentage. We would give it that COLA rate based on the Boston whatever market or whatever they call that, so that it would be based on that figure, not on a strict percentage, so that that could fluctuate with the cost of living, and we would not have to change our mode of doing things every year. That's just my opinion.
That's fine too. That a couple of years ago when we first talked about this, there is actually data that's easily accessible that the state of Vermont publishes. So it's easy for us, whether we get it from the New England Fed or we get it from the state of Vermont publishes the same report based on the same data. We can just use that report. And that becomes
so. I don't care how we do it. We can leave it the way you did it this year, but it should be clear that it's based on that raise, that percentage is based on that cost of living rate, rather than just a number picked out of the sky.
Okay. So what I would move then, just to make it clear, is that the board peg the cost of living increase to the state reported cost of living published actually January 1st of each year. And it's based, this is based on the Northeast Region CPI dash U, which is the same data you referred to.
And do you want to make that pay raise retroactive to the beginning of the fiscal year?
Yes, I would move that we make it retroactive to July 1.
Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second
and
that.
Does everyone understand it? I'm hearing no negatives, so I assume we all do. Are you ready to vote on that, or do you wish to discuss it more? I hear nothing, so I assume, are there any raised hands, John, or anything?
Let me check.
So I assume nobody's talking, so I assume you're ready for the vote. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. Okay, now we have merit / base pay raise road foreman and now road commissioner. So I'm open to a discussion regarding both those items.
Well, I guess the first question for the board is, which one do we want to tackle first, the merit or the base? We can go either one. I would suggest that the base might be the easier of the two conversations. But that's just a suggestion. It can be done either way.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
So Cindy pulled some figures. Let me see if I can get back to these. From various local towns. And did you send that to everybody, Cindy, or just to me?
No, just to you.
Let me send that to everybody.
Is this different than the data I sent out from the survey?
I didn't see your data from the survey.
I'm talking to the rest of the board. I sent the board data a couple of months ago when we first started this conversation.
We were talking.
I will just let me send it to you, and then you can figure out whether it is.
The 20 surrounding towns didn't all report.
That's correct.
So I just did a random sampling of the closest towns.
So I've just sent that to you. And towns that she used were Bennington, Bethel, Cavendish, Essex, Ludlow, Plymouth, Pomfret, Randolph, and Windsor. And you can see that.
But Emily, just to back up though, before we dive into this, that we agreed and we voted on that the data we would use is within a 20-mile radius. And some of these are. Some of them are and some of them aren't. And so we need to pull out the ones that are not. But the data I sent the board was of the towns that are within a 20-mile radius. And
so
of course,
can you pull that out and send that to us right now?
Yeah, I'll send it around again.
Scott, do you have the electronic data of that wage report?
You mean the whole survey?
Yes.
I do. I sent it to the rest of the board.
Is that for the statewide?
Yeah, it's VLCT statewide.
And you do have the electronic version?
Yep. I passed that around to everybody.
Would you share that with me?
Sure.
Thank you.
But I guess why, well, never mind. We can talk about it later. So I'm looking over.
A lot of this data is 3 years old.
No, this is not. Well, actually,
it says you're 2017.
Right. You're right. So some of it, I had to go back to the older surveys because it wasn't in the newer survey. But I can't imagine that those rates have changed dramatically from a couple of years ago.
Well, I would think they would. Hopefully, they would have gone up some. I mean, no.
Right. They may have gone up some, but they can't. I can't imagine they've gone up dramatically.
So what does anybody want to do now that you've seen this data?
So the email, so when we first talked about this a while back, I suggested to the board, and it was just that, just a suggestion, that the board could, let me pull up the email that I sent, make sure I'm quoting the right numbers. When was it? Having a hard time finding it. I don't even know when that was that we first started talking about it. But I think, yeah, I'm having a hard time digging back through my email, but the numbers that I recall is that we could comfortably raise the base wage somewhere, I think between $27 and $29 was sort of my suggestion based upon the data that we had.
Yeah, I sort of remember that you had sent something that had those numbers.
Yeah, pretty sure. Something like that.
Yeah.
And that from a base wage standpoint, that's where we could comfortably peg it.
Okay, so would someone like to make a motion regarding raising the base pay for this road foreman, road commissioner job?
I'll move that the board set the base wage for the road foreman's position to be $28 an hour.
I'll second that.
Okay, is there any more discussion on that part of this issue item? So, all those in favor then, signify by saying aye. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Emily? Aye. We're going to have to stop voting on things pretty soon. I can't remember who's here anymore. So, I have you pictured in my mind, but I'm starting to lose people. I apologize. So well, now we have to do the other thing, and that is a merit raise. How would you like to handle that? I'm looking for suggestions from any members of the board.
Well, based on our previous conversation, I would like to come at this, and again, this is just a suggestion. I would like to come at this less from grabbing a dollar figure from out of the air, but talking about, again, we're going to be making stuff up on the fly here, but as long as we vote on something that we can shape a policy, a future policy on, I think we're on good ground. And so I think, I'm just going to throw out, for sake of discussion, not necessarily for a vote, but I'm going to throw out some percentages that I think we could at least start to have a conversation about. And I would throw out, again, for the sake of discussion, that when, and leaving Jim's performance aside for a moment, when we have an employee who does their job and does it well, no bad marks, they're meeting all their expectations, they're room for improvement here and there, but generally hitting the mark, I think it would be actually quite generous to give that employee in the range of a 3.3% increase. When you start seeing stellar performance, you can start talking in the 5% range. And maybe we don't even have just a single number, but more of a range, like it's 3 to 4 or 5 to 7 or something like that. But my point here is to emphasize that whatever we do, it should be consistent anytime we're giving an employee a merit-based raise, that we are doing it in a consistent manner so that, we're not giving Jim a 5% raise this year and a 7% next year and a 10% another year, that we're not all over the map, that we've got some predictable methodology. I would say lastly, before ending my part on this, is that there's always that discretion, a manager's discretion, that even if somebody's doing a stellar job, there's always that discretion to say, you are knocking it out of the park and you hit the 5 to 7% range. And you know what? You're hitting it out of the park so well, we're going to tack on another discretionary 2 or 3%. So managers always have that at their disposal, but you want to be consistent in however you're making merit increases.
Okay, so does anyone else have any comments, thoughts? And or does someone want to make a motion?
I guess just to get something on the table and get this discussion moving, I would move, and taking this in two pieces, I would move that the board set, and this is as a general practice, set merit increases to be from 2 to 4% for meets expectations, and from 5 to 7% merit increase for someone who is exceeding expectations. Again, just getting the ball
five
rolled.
To what?
Five to seven.
Thanks.
Is there a second to that?
I'll second it just for discussion.
Is there discussion?
Yeah, I have discussion. While I can certainly make a case to go that high, just remember this isn't like it's a one-time, whoever it might be did a super awesome job, here's a 7% bonus. It's something that you're will continue in perpetuity. So, you know, if that happens year after year, they're hitting it out of the park, so to speak, that can increase one's wage significantly in a short period of time. And just one needs to be mindful of that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And again, I'm just, your point is well taken, John. And that's a reason to be cautious about what percentages to assign.
Right.
Here's the thing. There are different industries out there, different practices from company to company. You've got in the government sector, there are very, very well-defined brackets that people can move up into. And kind of to build on one of John's points, and this is certainly a topic for future discussion, but one of the things we might have done, and this is the way it works in the government sector, is that you have your merit increases, but after a certain period of time of performing, you actually move up a level. Like, for example, you could, in theory, have four different levels of road foremen. Not that we want to necessarily get that complicated, but just to illustrate the point, you could have like the level one road foreman, level two road foreman, level three foreman, and so on. And then after the merit increases, you say, hey, somebody's doing such a great job year after year. You were road foreman two, now we're gonna make you road foreman three, which entitles you to a bump in your base wage. And that's typically how you mitigate against or kind of balance the point that John is making, when that way you're not shortchanging anybody on their potential earning power by having a lower merit increase percentage. I'm not suggesting that that's what we do. I'm just illustrating the point. And I think that, what John said is important, but we also need to make sure we're awarding good performance or excellent performance too.
I would like to suggest that we have one category and not two. And for instance, take your 2 to 5, say instead of 2 to 4 and 5 to 7, say 2 to 5% meets or exceeds expectations. And you would give the higher percentage to those that meet and exceed expectations, and the lower to those that just meet expectations, and only have one one category to make it a little less confusing, and also a little less challenging to explain what it takes to exceed or knock it out of the park, so to speak. And that would only be my suggestion. Those figures are negotiable. I don't have any feeling with that, but I do have a feeling that I would like to see it one range rather than two, and have it go that way. But I'm willing to. That's only the feeling I have at the moment, and I can't quite explain why I feel that. But I feel there's some connotations there that I would. I would be more comfortable with just one rate, and have it a larger spread. That's only my thought.
It sounds reasonable to me. Sensible to me.
It sounds good, Emily. I don't know that it's any less complicated because you still have the challenge of figuring out where someone falls. But I do agree with you that approach is equally fine. So I'll amend my motion, I'll move that the board set merit pay increase range to be from 2 to 5%.
I'll second that.
Is there a second for that?
Second.
Thank you. Is there any more discussion? Are you ready for that motion then? Hearing no discussion. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve? Is Steve there?
Oh, sorry, I didn't get to mute. Aye.
Are you there? Are you aye? Yes.
Aye.
Yeah.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. So now the only part left is what kind of a merit raise. We have a merit raise for all employees that might be anywhere from 2 to 5%. So what are you going to set in addition to the increase in base pay that we voted on? What percentage are you going to give our road foreman this year?
Well, I guess I'll kick it off since nobody else has stepped up. And again, I'm just trying to get the conversation going. So I'll move that we award Jim a merit increase of 4%.
I'll second that.
Is there any more discussion?
Just for number's sake, that's $1.12 an hour.
So you're going to have him at $29.12.
Yeah, I was doing the math too, John.
I did as well. Anyway, so is there any more discussion? All those in favor of that?
Wait. I want to discuss it just a little bit further.
Okay.
I feel like this is a hit it out of the park situation, and I would like to see it at the top of that range at the 5%.
That's going to be $1.40, I believe.
Yeah. So right. That's my take.
Did we get a second on the motion?
I seconded yours.
Okay, so Chuck, you're offering an amendment to the motion, or?
Well, we're discussing it, and that's
oh,
my
okay.
Yeah, right?
Okay.
So I would offer an amendment to the motion. I would offer that in consideration of the fact that I believe, and I think most of us do believe, it's Jimmy has hit it pretty well out of the park, and it should be at the top of the range, so it should be 5%.
I'll second it.
Any more discussion? All those in favor of the amendment to Scott's original motion to change the percentage from 4 to 5%, signify by saying aye. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself, aye. Thank you. End of discussion. I wasn't sure we were going to make it. So Jimmy will be getting a $28 base pay plus a 5% increase on top of that, plus the cost of living increase. Correct?
Yes, and I'm just thinking.
Where does the cost of living increase come? Because that technically that would be the first of the physical year, which would be before the pay adjustment. So
So there would be a period of time from July 1 until now, unless we could take up a second motion to.
You can always make this pay increase retroactive, but either way, you still have to decide whether that cost of living is going to go on to the base pay or whether it's going to go on the whole package or how you're going to do that. So we voted to do the cost of living increase retroactive to the beginning of the fiscal year. Right?
Well, I think that's because when we do that, I don't know. So we would be making these other adjustments that we just made retroactive to the beginning of the year, but.
Not the beginning of the year, the beginning of the fiscal year.
Well, that's what I meant.
So we have to clarify exactly what we're doing here.
I'm going to make another motion. Only because the period of performance technically actually preceded the beginning of the calendar year, even though we didn't get his review done.
Fiscal year.
Yes, it preceded the fiscal year. Did I say calendar?
Yeah,
yes.
You did.
Sorry about that. So I think in all fairness that the merit increase and I'm not so sure about the base, but at least the merit increase, we should probably just do it all in one shot and make it retroactive to the beginning of the fiscal year. And again, I say that because truly the period of performance here is, even again, that we're getting the review done now, it really was the basically beginning of June period of performance.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Should we be going back any further than that? Because no, we never did do a six-month review either.
Well, we did do a six-month review, actually.
We did a verbal one, not a formal one.
Right, yeah, but we didn't do any increase for Jim's pay then, because at that time we were trying to formulate how we were going to, do the whole pay scale kind of thing.
Right.
And I believe it was you, Scott, right? Back then you said we could even retroactive, have it go back to that date.
Yeah, if we really, really wanted to, we could go back to the 6 month period. I'm just suggesting that the review that we just did, or that we're working on, is for the 1 year period. So I think in good conscience, it would, at a minimum, it would be going back to July 1.
Let's make life simple for Ellen and for us, and we will have all of the cost of living go retroactive to July 1 because it was not necessarily Jim's fault. Things just didn't fall the way they should have to get this review done by the 1st of July, which we should have gotten it done in June. That was his anniversary, was about the 10th of June. Let's make his raise retroactive to the 1st of July as well. And so you would give him the increase in base pay and the percentage as of the 1st of July. And because that was in effect on the 1st of July, then indeed his COLA would go on top of that. Just like it does on the other two road crew members and anyone else, you're going to make it retroactive to.
His COLA and his merit increase both based on the 28.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yes, right. From July 1st.
So that to make it everything consistent for Ellen, let's just do everything as of July 1.
Right.
That's fine. So I'll move, just so we have a formal motion, I'll move that we make the cost of living adjustment, the merit increase, and the base wage adjustment effective July 1st.
Second.
Is there a second? Thank you. Is everyone ready to vote on that? Are there any qualms or reconsiderations here? Excellent. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. Okay. Thank you very much. We did that and we made it. I'm impressed. Thank you. I got a letter from the Census Bureau regarding boundary validation for the boundaries in Pomfret. This has to be responded in 5 days. I got it on Monday. Ellen, I'm told in the document, is the point person. That being said, she knew nothing about it, and I sent the document to Neil because there was a boundary dispute between Barnard and Pomfret. Not a dispute, but a disagreement as to where the boundary on Stage Road between Barnard and Pomfret was. Neil was on the select board when that all transpired. This boundary validation is incorrect. And so I will send the documents back to the Census Bureau that indicates that the boundary validation is not correct. And I will go and consult with Neil if the board wishes to get the correct boundary in the Census Bureau's data points, and then we will have to sign off on it being corrected if I have the board's authority to do that.
And that's because it doesn't agree with the boundary as corrected back
in 2008 or 10 or whenever
2008.
It was.
That's when we moved Marilyn Wilhelm from Pomfret to Barnard.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I will fill out that document that it is incorrect, and hopefully we can get it corrected with within the site that Neil directed me to, and I will seek out Neil's guidance if need be, because these boundaries are the listers' problems, not necessarily the select board's.
Yeah.
Do I have the authority to do that and get that squared away?
Yeah. Do you need a motion?
I'll make a motion that we do that.
Yeah, I'll second it.
Thank you. All those in favor? John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Myself? Aye. I'm sorry, Scott, I forgot you. Scott?
Aye.
I apologize. I told you I was losing it. Okay, meeting wrap-up. Select Board correspondence. I'll be honest, I didn't check the box today when I was up there, and so I have none, other than this boundary validation thing. Review of assignments. Scott, you were going to try and check and see regarding the delinquent taxes and how the tax sale would fit into that emergency declaration and the legislature's situation there. I will do this boundary validation thing. The conflict of interest policy we will attach to the next agenda and deal with that. Jimmy was going to take care of the Starbuck Lucott permit and the one for Sam Neustadt. And
get signs for the
what were we going to do with the Pike bill?
Ellen's to ask for a revised invoice.
Thank you. What else are there, were there for assignments, Cindy?
That's it.
Oh, and Steve is going to do a spreadsheet on the truck bids.
Right. Yeah.
Anything else that I've forgotten? Agenda items for next meeting, other than continuation of some of these things and the conflict of interest policy, is there anything else?
I'd like to put on the agenda for next time re-engaging with our HR person now that we've got money in the budget for that HR assistance in this fiscal year. I think it'd be a good time to re-engage her on some of the topics we talked about before.
We'll put it on the agenda. Anything else right now? I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Was there a second?
Second.
Third.
Thank you. All in favor, John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Myself, aye. Thank you all very much.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah.